Wash, a leading anti-corruption investigation body that has put scores of top politicians and billionaires behind bars since 2014.
The United Nations General Assembly has once again passed a resolution calling on Israel to withdraw from Syria's Golan Heights, territory that the Tel Aviv regime has occupied since 1967. The Assembly adopted the resolution, which had been proposed by 37 countries, by an overwhelming majority. The resolution also condemned Israel's non-compliance to the Security Council Resolution 497 since 1981 until the present, describing as null and void Tel Aviv's decision issued on December the 14th, 1981, to impose its control over the occupied Golan Heights. Israel seized the Golan Heights from Syria after the 1967 Six-Day War and later occupied it in a move that has never been recognized by the international community. The regime has built numerous illegal settlements in the area and has used the region to carry out military operations against the Syrian government.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
View, when people ask me, what do I think about Iraq, I tell them, it's one of the greatest strategic mistakes we ever made.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, for not having taken care of the Iranian problem before, we went ahead with that. I mean, what we did, we destroyed the Sunni-Shia balance. We should not be involved in this sectarian Sunni-Shia war that has gone on for over 1,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, my view is let them kill each other off,
right.
Number one. And while I'm at that, I might add, we should not embrace anything that approaches the failed coin strategy, which have cost the lives and the devastating injuries to many of our military personnel. This idea we had to go out and march without a protected vest or a blast diagram to show how we want to integrate and win the hearts and minds of the local, what pure nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
And my view is when you want to win their hearts and minds, there's one way you do it. In the Middle East, there's only one thing that counts. It's street respect. And the way you get street respect, you kill them into submission. And once you do that, I guarantee you the hearts and minds will follow.
Angry Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for Indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! Indian land!
You guys have no jurisdiction here.
Listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me, Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man mean you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians, all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. White man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet Radio for the smart of the region.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump was questioned by Chris Wallace of Fox News Sunday over his plans to skip daily presidential intelligence briefings.
I just want to ask you about your skepticism about the intelligence community. You are getting the presidential daily brief only once a week.
Well, I get it when I need it.
But is there some skepticism?
First of all, these are very good people that are giving me the briefings. And I say, if something should change from this point, immediately call me. I'm available on 1 minute's notice. I don't have to be told, you know, I'm like a smart person. I don't have to be told the same thing and the same words every single day for the next 8 years.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
Internet radio for smart of the original.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from within occupied North America. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, Saluton and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. You have tuned in to Indigenous news, thought, and analyses concerning issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under colonial, imperial, theological, racialist, homophobic, misogynist, neoclassist, neoliberal, neoliteral, neo-fascist, and those communities suffering from pro-capitalist, anti-environmental oppression. I'm your host, the Angry Indian, Editor-in-Chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the people of the Fourth World from aboriginalnewswire.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com, as well as our main news portal, ang-newswire.blogspot.com. And along with my co-executive producer and master studio engineer, Ms. Guadalupe Morales, we welcome you back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the official broadcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service, coming straight at you from Everyman Studios in Multnomah Nation Territories. You know, it's really crazy what the fuck is going on. I mean, are you looking? Are you paying attention? Is anyone listening? I mean, really, is anyone paying attention to this? Trump has, they were wailing about Goldman Sachs, handouts to Goldman Sachs. What was it, Lou? Yeah, Hillary Clinton's connections. Yeah, basically, right? You know, hang her, jail her, right? All of that type of bullshit that they were saying. You know, this is what Trump, wrote on. Then he publicly encouraged the Russian government, or at least the hackers that do business for the Russian government, that do their legwork. He asked them, he publicly requested that they hack into her computers so that they can find out everything they can about her connections to Goldman Sachs, because Goldman Sachs is part of the bailout. A lot of these libertarian types, not so much the Republicans, right? You know, those who lean to the libertarian / alt-right bullshit, you know, Nazis. But you dig what I'm saying? you know, those who think that they're so goddamn intellectual that they understand something that the rest of us don't, you know, the ones that think Calvin Coolidge was important, you know, those guys, right, Luke, those guys. All right. So anyway, yeah, he's got Goldman Sachs people all up in the goddamn government now, right? And who was it? Some other exec from energy. Yeah, they all got energy connections. And then what was it? What did he say? Well, put it up on my screen. She's talking about somebody's a friend of, somebody's a friend of Trump's that he's got on. But that was the same thing happened with Paul Manafort, right? It's the same thing. No, I don't. I still don't see who you're talking about here. Well, anyway, I'm sorry for the dead air, but yeah, I mean, there's a few things that I'm looking at here that she put up on my monitor. This one's from the Washington Post. In Germany, the language of Nazism is no longer buried in the past. In Germany. Now that's the Washington Post, right? Which of course is stateside base. Then you have Breitbart News. Now this is coming from The Economist, which is British. And apparently, Lupe's husband was telling me about this. I mean, I had heard this before, but apparently it's still like this. There's only about, in a round figure, what'd you say, Lupe? It's like 1,100 people around the world. Around the world. That literally subscribe for hard copies of The Economist. So your household and mine are basically part of that 1,100 because I didn't realize that. I mean, you know, that is the, and look, this is not an ad spot for them. And no, whoever the fuck you conspiracy theorists are, no, I am not a member. I'm not a fucking Freemason. And the Illuminati is some bullshit that ended with the death of Adam Weishaupt. Now, there might have been some copycats after that, but that bullshit is done with. It's gone nowhere. It's done. It's done. Anything after Adam Weishaupt is bullshit. You know, kind of like claiming to be a Crip and you're not from L.A. It's like, you know what the fuck? You know, a B-boy and you're not from New York City, right? It's like, what the fuck? What? Yeah, that's a good one. Somebody was talking about that too. That punk rock started in the States. On the East Coast, right? And, what do you call it? Used to go out there to the shows with the punk rockers. The Skinheads. That started in the UK, even though they were copying black Jamaicans. You know, kind of like Eminem in hip hop, right? Skinheads and, ska, right? Same thing. Because when the press came in, they totally ignored black people and looked at the white guys. Go back and look at it. Go back and look at it. You know, when you look at the history of skin, I mean, the whole point of being a skinhead is, you know, ska music, right? But ska is black music. You know, which in turn, if you go even goddamn deeper, you know, I mean, really. Ska, rock steady, backbeat, what have you, started with black American soldiers who took their jazz, blues, you know, and R&B, what have you, albums with them. They were stationed in Jamaica, took that shit with them, and would leave that with those girls, you know, or the people that they became friends with. You know, that is how the record industry got started in Jamaica, was the inspiration that they were getting from gospel records, which was more than anything else, I understand. But, you know, it was gospel records, rhythm and blues, jazz. Right? The British, for whatever reason, didn't leave them anything, you know, in terms of a musical tradition. So, you know, and I suppose they were already playing drums to some sort of degree because, you know, people of color, that's what we do, you know. But anyway, I mean, that's the heartbeat of a people, right? Yeah, I know, I'm going on a tangent. Roll with me. Because now you got me thinking about this bullshit. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, she wants me to remind people because we haven't seen it yet. Story of Skinhead. It was a brother that produced the shit. The cat that used to manage the Clash. I can't remember his name right. Don Letts, right? Yeah, Don Letts. You know, the same brother who said that when MTV, for those of us old enough to remember, I want my MTV commercials and shit, he went in to represent the Clash. And they told him that the service elevator was down the hall and to the left. He said that that happened, you know, and I believe him. So anyway, yeah, fucking MTV. Yeah, because, you know, people had told me who were in the music business, because I do know some, or at least used to. They used to sleep on my floors and shit when they didn't have any money. You know, fucking, you know, when they started, you know, getting up there, right? They started telling, because these are the white boys and the people that I'm talking about. These are the white cats that were engineering these albums, that were producing these albums, assisting to the producers for these albums, with sometimes duty arranging what happened for these albums. You know, all the background bullshit. You have black talent, but white expertise making the sounds come out right. See, you know, that's what was the big deal about Jimmy Cliff when we started talking about skinhead and shit, because he was black and was able to do this. You know, he somehow went in there, somebody, he got a mixing board somehow, and he figured it out. And, you know, the two white fellas, no, I'm not going to name them, because then I'd be accused of name dropping, right? No, I'm not going to name them. The two fellas that, you know, I know, they said, yeah, you know, that they, you know, a lot of it had to do with brothers just wanted to sing and dance and really weren't interested in producing anything. And then eventually, you know, now you will notice you have a lot of brothers that do have that expertise, but it wasn't always motherfucking like that. And to a large degree, it kind of still isn't like that, but as these fellas, the last time I saw one of them anyway, he told me there's, you know, there's activity in terms of keeping, at least with black men, I don't know what else is going on, because both of these gentlemen, I'm talking about, are white men who work in black music, and motherfucking, they're like, yeah, you know, there's a concerted effort to keep black people from actually getting that knowledge, and if they do get it, to keep them out of the studio. So, you know, there was, in one sense, one of these fellas was telling me is that if you see a black man or an all black crew, basically, it's because, you know, it's a private studio. It's not, it's not something coming from, you know, a contractual arrangement with one of these labels. So anyway, why am I talking about that? I don't motherfucking know. I was originally talking about, if you're not, from England, you know, perhaps you're not really a skinner. You know, maybe. I don't know. You know, I mean, people get angry about that. Probably. But, you know, what I'm trying to say is, I mean, all of this shit is fugazi when you really motherfucking talk about it. All of it. Right? I mean, if we're gonna, you know, cause I had originally started saying that, I mean, if you look at the written history of this, and we always know that the written history is never really exactly what the fuck, how things really worked out, right? I mean, if you want to talk about, you know, again, punk rock, I mean, there were clubs all up and down, you know, from, you know, in the early, well, anywhere from, say, depending on who you want to talk to, 1973, I guess, up until like 1980. But punk, I guess, is what? Yeah, what? Because we're old enough to remember, like, what? 1977, right? Like, I remember the Knits. You know, and the outfit then was the spiky hair with the fucking black suits and loose ties and Converse sneakers, right? Or, you know, some shit like that. Yeah. Yeah, black Converse, right? With, yeah. Yeah, because everybody, I don't know, man. You know, it's like my memories of a lot of that shit was, you know, a fucked up or a mixture of aromas, you know, Aquanet and goddamn vomit. Because a lot of people were dropping pills and shit, and they were throwing up all over the fucking place because they were mixing it with alcohol. You know, I mean, that's what I remember. But you might remember something different, you know. But in any case, I was talking about, you know, looking at the history of these things and going back, you know, in terms of, you know, what's legitimate and what isn't. Because that's the question, because, you know, cultures and shit move. I mean, how many goddamn people, regardless of ethnicity, in North America, you know, at first I started seeing this in Vancouver, but you know, down here, you know, in British Columbia, but you know, down here, you know, how many people who are not Asian, don't have any Asian background whatsoever? Not even, you know, the idea that, well, maybe, you know, I might be part with it. And have Chinese and Japanese written on them. And shit that's all wrong, you know, things that really because I can read a little Mandarin. You know, fucking, you know, things that's supposed to be good luck, and it's really turtle. Yeah, you know, I mean, I've seen some that were, you know, pure insults. You know, written insults, yeah. Yeah, especially in Japanese, right? You know, they think it's kanji or katagana or what have you, and it turns out to be some, you know, really fucked up gaijin or potato kind of, you know, insult. And especially with, especially with service people, if they can get them. I was told about this anyway in Okinawa and what have you. They'll tattoo ghost on them and tell them that it's good luck or some bullshit like that. I don't know if it's true or not. But anyway, you know, why am I talking about this? Well, because a lot of this, you know, confusion in terms of why, you know, Trump was able to do what the fuck he does and why we're not calling the alt-right the Nazis that they are, you know, the neo-Nazis, the new Nazis that they are, is because we have a lot of confusion about who is what and who really is what, right? You know, I mean, people of color walk around with a hell of a lot of goddamn confusion. I mean, those of you who listen to the Bob Kincaid Show, which I hope you do, check him out at headonradio.com. And yeah, there's a lot of ways you can get his show, and he has a podcast that's free. So I advise you to go check it out. And if you can afford so, drop him a dime or two. You know, he really could use the coins so he can stay on the air. You know, Lupe did, you did want me to say this, even though I should have probably started off with this. Yeah, I know, I'm going on another tangent, bro. You know, we apologize for not being in here, but right now it's been scheduling, you know. I mean, she and I both, like I say, you know, we're trying to maintain, you know, our own our own family. So, you know, we're not getting paid for this. We don't ask for anything because we know you don't have it. And, you know, it's all cool. But we do apologize. You know, we just want you to know if we're not doing the show, it's because we haven't been able to get in here. You know, sometimes, you know, we just can't get a booking for a room in here, or, you know, she can't make it, I can't make it, it just happened. So, you know, we just wanted to put that out there, and as 2017 rolls, you know, we're going to at least do one, two, before the year goes out, you know, one of them, we're going to do a roundup, and, you know, like we've tried, and don't really accomplish, but we'll try. Yeah, you know, if you don't hear from us, it's because we couldn't get in here, you know. So, you know, that means basically if you want radio like this on a regular basis, you're either going to have to do it yourself or you're going to have to really financially support those that are out there trying to do this, because it takes a lot of time to fucking do, you know, to put on a quality show any goddamn way. It takes time and, you know, resources, what have you, you know, distribution, what have you, you know, I mean, a lot of, you know, her and I, we don't always really have time to fucking sit on a computer and keep, you know, pumping this out. And if you want to, you know, help, because we don't particularly ask for financial donations. We don't ask for swag or anything like that, equipment donations or anything like that. You know, we try to do this as off the coin as much as possible, using the best out there in terms of open source, you know, resources, you know. For the most part, you're going to have to help somebody out to really do this type of media, you know. But again, we implore you to, you know, do something yourself. But what was it? Yeah, I know, because I'm trying to get a bunch of things out here and you're still sending me pages. I can't read all of this at the same time. All right, hold up. Yeah, if you want to help the show, because we don't ask for anything, you know, we would encourage you to let people know about it. You know, when you hear something you like, right, you know, let people know about it. You know, send the link out. You know, I mean, word of mouth is basically what keeps this show going. And we also wanted to say thank you, because Lupe's been going through the Google Analytics, right? Yeah, because I don't have the patience for that, man. I don't have the patience for that. But anyway, she's been looking at it. And we wanted to say thank you very much to the listeners in Sweden. We wanted to say thank you to our listener in Iceland. Hello. However you say hello up there. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people who do understand English, not just expats, who are checking the show out. And we really appreciate it. Chile, we understand we still got a listener down in Chile. Hello to our listeners in the UK. Occupy Canada, of course, New Zealand, Hobart, of course, Australia, the land down under. Of course, we always have a big hello and good day to you. You know, obviously, people are listening to the show. And it depends in terms of, you know, subject matter, how many particular downloads the podcast might get. And, you know, yeah, the numbers are interesting. And, yeah, I like to see high numbers, of course. You know, why wouldn't I? But, you know, the real thing is, you know, we only want to really do this when we know that we can actually make some sort of contribution. If we can get you to look at situations another way, you know, I mean, I would like to say that we were a news program per se. That's not really the case. I mean, this is news and opinion, really. You know, I mean, I've tried, you know, before Lupe came around to do a straight up news show, but it's really difficult because all I can give you is my opinion. I can't go to North Dakota to actually, you know, do an on-the-site thing. I can't. You know, I mean, we tried with the Aboriginal News Group in its early stages with our original founders. We tried to do that, but, you know, I've talked about this too. And yes, I'm going on a tangent. Roll with me. You know, yeah, I know that, right, Luke? You know, I mean, this is why this is really spoken word as opposed to even news and opinion. You know, we tried. We really tried. We were based in Australia and South Africa, right? And North America. And what happened? Our email was fucked with. Our site was fucked with. All of our sites were fucked with. You know, now, you know, one of the brothers has passed on. The other one, she's, you know, kind of retired from all of this. She's raising her family, you know, that sister. But the three of us certainly tried. We certainly goddamn tried. And the sister in Australia was having some legal problems at the time, right? So, you know, we tried to actually do things in such a way that would, you know, get information out about her case without jeopardizing what the fuck her case was about, because anything that was going to be said was going to be twisted that she, you know, had a bias against white people and hated everybody. And of course, that wasn't the case. But, you know, not being able to communicate and not being able to communicate fully, not trusting emails we were receiving, you know, all three of us are posting articles, posting links that didn't get up there. I'm posting articles, essays, and what have you that weren't get out there. I mean, there's at least two of my goddamn, you know, in-depth stories. One was about Assange, not really defending Assange, but, you know, kind of deconstructing what the fuck was going on around him and the fact that this probably is a honeypot case against him, which doesn't mean that Julian Assange isn't a fucking, you know, supporter of fascism. We already know that he was giving money to Ron Paul, which I pointed out in the piece, and that he's got some shaky connections himself to some fascists, right, in Australia. And he has been online, you know, even though he's been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy over in the UK. But the point is, he has put out some, you know, really questionable, you know, anti-Jewish shit himself via Twitter. So it's like, wait a minute, you know, I pointed all this out. But it doesn't mean that the propaganda against Libya wasn't true. You know, I mean, well, really, it wasn't even about Assange, but it was part of it. I'm just talking about propaganda in general. It was called, you know, not at Rape Matters in Africa. Yeah. Where I talked about the woman who came into the hotel screaming, first in Arabic, and then when the cameras were picked up and the microphones, then it turned into English. And then she disappeared. And then some months later, she popped up on the BBC and didn't confirm anything. And then we never saw her again. But this was the, you know, this was the moral thing that was started against the government of Gaddafi, which isn't to say that the government of Gaddafi was all that goddamn great. But wait a minute. His military was not out there doing mass rapes. Even Human Rights Watch eventually came down to admit that. And Amnesty International and the World Health Organization and every other goddamn non-governmental agency that's, you know, attached to the UN who was down there. It said that it was bullshit. It wasn't true. But how did we slip into that? Well, when I was talking earlier about identity, I think it has a lot to do with that. And see, and this is one of the reasons why the neo-Nazis are holding clout. Now, think about this. We're talking about ska music, like I said earlier. Now, we already broke down, you know, black soldiers from the South, you know, were taking gospel, jazz, blues records with them when they were doing their service in Jamaica. They do their service in Jamaica. they leave. They go back stateside. These albums stay there. It inspires the type of music that you hear. I mean, look at the films, Countryman or motherfucking, what's that shit with Jimmy Cliff where he played the gangster? I can't remember, but those of you who are into Jamaican film, black film, African cinema, which is what we should call it. I can't remember the name of the film. But anyway, you know, he plays a country boy who, because it's not country, man. You know, he plays a country boy, goes to city, gets ripped off the first day motherfucking gets there, and, you know, tries to be a singer, what have you, becomes homeless, you know, becomes a gangster, becomes famous, and dies. Famous. So evidently, he got whatever it is within the context, the cultural context of his understanding of the world, his view of the world, he got the full circle of fate, right? So you listen to the music and then you can hear the gospel in it. You can hear the blues in it because all of that shit comes from the black experience of being a motherfucking slave in the United States. So they take these albums to the island of Jamaica, right? The British don't give them a musical tradition. They hook up with these black soldiers and they get a musical, or they start to develop around this. Now, as they start immigrating to the UK, you know, for jobs, the factory jobs, right? You know, they start going to the north and shit. Where's they, Luke? Yeah, you know, when they started going to Newcastle, you know, people from Trinidad and shit start going to fucking Newcastle and Nottingham and what have you. And all the fucking way up north, right? And, yeah, and through Brixton, the East End, what have you, all of that. So, they're living in council houses in some cases, right next to white people. So of course, just like with hip hop, they're gonna listen to it. Of course. They look at black style, they copycat it. You know, those of you who are black in the United States anyway, will remember, you know, at least back in the 70s, what we used to call in Jersey anyway, they had a, I forgot what we called it in Philly, well, in Jersey, they called it a Caesar, right? I just remember them calling it a shortcut in Philly. I don't remember any nickname for it. You know, it's some, maybe where I, well, I just don't remember one. But I remember it being called a Caesar when I would get it at the barber shop up in Newark, right? For, what was it? How much? Oh, back then, a haircut was like, I don't know, buck and a half, right? You could get a lineup for a dollar. You know, 75, something like that, yeah. Anyway, well, you know what I'm talking, well, some of you out there know what I'm talking about anyway. So anyway, you get your, you know, your Caesar, and they would, because you can't part this kind of motherfucking hair, right? So they would shave a part in so we could look like the white boys, right? Well, the early skinheads and shit, I'm not talking about suedes, I'm talking about skinheads. When you look at the history of this shit, and you can go online and find out quite a bit, you know, they were copying the black kids so much that when they got their hair cut short, and they weren't shaving their heads back then, that had more to do with the Nazis that came in around later, but, or boneheads as they call it in their literature, but in any case, they started shaving in the same fucking part. They didn't do that beforehand, you know, they could just comb their shit over, right? So, you know, they were totally influenced by these black kids. They picked up the slang, the walking, the dress, you know, all of that. And when the press started paying attention to it, just like with the modernists or the hard mods or whatever the fuck before them, they just totally forgot about the black kids, ignored the black kids completely, ignored Scott. Well, actually, in many cases, like when you go online and you look at a lot of this shit, they don't mention ska music. But they don't talk about black people at all. Black people are totally, you know, out of the conversation. You know, this out. Non-existent at this point. They start talking about, you know, skinheads. Now, there was always racism in this shit because there's always been racism with white people. Which doesn't mean that they still didn't listen to ska music and didn't say what's up to a black kid, you know, depending on the social circumstances, right? Because he may not say anything to him in school, but he would say something to him in the neighborhood on the same block in front of the sweet shop. You understand what I'm saying? you know, all of these contradictions and shit were totally, you know, not brought in, you know, totally ignored in this. And you got to remember when you look at history about this. Written history is just that. It's the written history. You know, what the fuck was really going on down there? You know, I mean, the idea that the Nazis have been saying since they lost, and the Confederates here in the United States have been saying ever since they lost, is that, you know, history is subjective, right? That, you know, history is basically what you make it. So they're complaining and have been complaining and whining and, you know, this bloody diarrhea all over the goddamn place. I mean, for decades, for generations. About how the South will rise again and all this type of shit. I mean, these were fucking traitors. And they were allowed to do this. But we never ask ourselves, or at least I know why. But we never ask ourselves, why is this allowed to happen? I mean, in Germany, for example, even though I just read... Let me pull it up here again. Yeah, the Washington Post. Now, this is by Anthony Fiola and Stephanie Kirchner for, you know, December 9th. So... You know, this just came out yesterday, that fucking in Germany, the language of Nazism is no longer buried in the past. Now, you know, as you know, most of you should know who are politically aware, cognizant, and active, that, you know, you cannot promote Nazism in Germany. It is against the law. It is still against the motherfucking law. You cannot wave a Nazi flag. You can't promote any of that bullshit. They will prosecute you, right? But, you know, here in the United States, you can wave all the Confederate fucking flags you want. You know, even though we know, because the man who goddamn created the fucking flag put it in writing. This is the white man's flag. And we also know that it represents a rebellious fucking government that was willing to fight tooth and goddamn nail, not so much just to keep blacks enslaved. I mean, of course, that was the issue. You know, that was one of the main issues. But the bottom fucking line is they were ready to fight the goddamn federal government in order to do that. And they've been allowed to, you know, the Daughters of the American Revolution, all that kind of shit. One white man supporting another white man. They've been allowed to fucking, you know, do this over the decades. So, you know, and they've been trying over the fucking decades. They've been trying through Goldwater. They tried through Reagan. Okay, they tried through George Wallace, right? They tried through Woodrow Wilson to do this. But it's really important that they did it in modern days through Ronald Reagan. You know, and they got their jabs here and there. But, you know, here we go with Trump, right? Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, why I'm not intentionally leaving out Bush and Cheney. But the thing about Bush and Cheney was, that wasn't their particular spiel. They were into oil. They were into making money from petroleum. So they were not really paying attention to the white supremacists. You know, they let them do what the fuck they were going to do, and they didn't have any real backing because people were working because the Clinton administration was in for two goddamn decades, right? So motherfuckers had jobs, you understand what I'm saying? Until shit started breaking down, like say maybe when GM started moving south. Because we have to remember that, you know, even though Clinton came in and people had work, he was a progressive Republican, a compassionate conservative, right? So, you know, then comes in the real goddamn party, you know, card-carrying Republican, and $3.some-odd trillion of fucking money gone. You know, a whole bunch of wars started that, you know, that are unending. He wrecks the entire motherfucking world's goddamn economy with the subprime loan scandal, allows that to fucking happen. Allows Katrina to fucking happen, allows the bridges and the roads and shit to fall apart. And I mean, at no time do you say to yourself, something's wrong, something's out of place. And it's like, how did we get to this point? Well, you know, you got a lot of white people who never really fucking said to themselves, who the fuck are we? And I'm not talking about in terms of what this bullshit alternative right is talking about. Because what they're talking about is nonsense. When I'm talking about, they never asked themselves as white Americans who the fuck they are. Have they ever come to terms about what happened here with Native people? No, because we can look at the Dakota Access Pipeline protest and see that they don't give a fuck about what happens to Native people. They never gave a fuck about what happens to Native people. It never would have got this far if they gave a fuck about what happened to Native people. And yeah, you know, I've been criticized on the street. Well, I'm not talking about Dakota Access Pipeline enough. Well, that's not, I don't think, fair, because I've certainly put enough call-outs there for people who are on site to let me know what the fuck was happening. And if you have an opinion, to contact me and let me know what the fuck is happening. You can always reach me on Twitter, at The Angry Indian, one word, right? You can always email us, 4th World Radio, number 4, TH, World Radio, at gmx.pt. You know, you can always contact us. You can always go through Aboriginal Press, at Aboriginal Press on Twitter, and find us. It's not as if we're out here, you know, not trying to report on it, but what did I just say earlier? You know, we do not have the resources to be on site to report accurately about what the fuck is happening. So we have to call, like everybody else, what's coming across the internet, you know. So, you know, in terms of asking me why I'm not CNN, you know, isn't fair. Can only do but so much. And I'm trying to report shit accurately. Right? So, you know, in order to do that, usually, in order for me to, you know, give you exactly what I think is happening, I have to actually beat it. I can't do that. But see, here you got, and where this relates, what I'm talking about is, you have a whole lot of goddamn white folks, man, who cannot say to themselves that they let this situation get as far as it's gotten because they've never been honest with themselves about their relationship to Native people. They've never been honest with themselves about their relationship to Black people in this country or across the world. They've never been honest with themselves about very much. So we're in a position now to where, because they're looking for identity in Black culture or looking for identity in Asian culture, because they're out there. Ask your friends in the Asian community how you got people who want to tell and correct Chinese people on Asian history, Asian culture, Asian mannerisms and what have you, Asian protocol. And then you got Arab, you know, the Arabist, right, who wants to tell the Arab what it is to be Arab, who they are as Arabs and what have you. You know, this is a real trip. This is a real trip. And it should be up for discussion, but it isn't. I mean, I didn't have a topic. But, you know, it should be up for discussion, but it isn't. Because this has a lot to do with how the fuck we got here. The sense of identity. The sense of loss of identity. Now, you know, in some senses, I can understand the whole Brexit, or the anti-Brexit thing, in the sense that you have places like Alsace-Lorraine that have a particular culture, or you have Basque Country, which has a particular culture, and they feel that it's going to be washed out if they are forced to economically get together, because, of course, that's also going to involve culture, social, religious, and, you know, whatever the fuck, you know, other social and civic concerns you might have in terms of how people identify themselves. Now, I'm going to be straight up. It is confusing when, and because this has happened to me recently, where I met a fellow. I mean, for all kinds of purposes, he looked like a black man, right? But he is half Chinese, and I mean literally half Chinese. But he was all African in turn, you know, except in terms of some of his features. But we can look at our brothers and sisters who are not mixed like we are here in North America, and we'll see what we would say maybe Asian, you know, characteristics, which has a lot to do with their, some of us anyway, leaving Eastern Africa and going up into Asia and then spreading and then coming back into Africa. So, you know, all of this, I mean, you can look at the Human Genome Project, despite the questions that we might have about it as indigenous people. I know our brothers and sisters in Australia are not particularly happy about it, but, you know, the bottom line is life started in Africa. but using that as an excuse to be racist, to cut people, you know, of color off from resources, what have you, it's a crock of shite. It's a crock. And what it says to me anyway, when you're a neo-Nazi and when you're a black supremacist or you're an Asian supremacist, because they're out there. I mean, they're out there in Japan and China, for damn sure. There's xenophobia out there. They don't want to see their women marrying black men because you got a whole lot of cross-cultural shit going on between Africa and China right now, right? You got a lot of business. So what do you think is happening? You got a lot of Chinese men who are going to Africa. They're coming back with African wives. They're having children in China. Their children are going to school and everything. I mean, they're winning contests and shit. I mean, they're on TV. You know, Taiwan has the same thing where you got a lot of African men who came in there to do construction work and shit, and they're marrying and staying there, and they're raising families. And in turn, you got a lot of Chinese that are, you know, staying in Africa and being, you know, raising families and shit and their kids. Hey, this is what happens. This is what happens with contact. So this is what the whole anti-Brexit shit in many ways was about, because people were willing to throw away their motherfucking, you know, economic well-being just to keep out outsiders.
Or the fear of that. The fear of their daughters and shit marrying Arab men, you know, or Turks or some shit. So, you know, in the U.S. was the same thing. Trump got in because a lot of white people liked his racist rhetoric. And when I really think about it, Loop, I don't think a whole lot of them even know what the fuck Goldman Sachs is. Let alone the significance of him bringing in Goldman Sachs people after all of the crap he was saying about Hillary Clinton, because they were okay with Petraeus and his emailing his mistress a whole bunch of secret documentation and the names of, you know, active operatives and agents and covert people around the world. So and they were okay with that. So they'll be okay with just about anything because they're simpletons. You know, fascists are simpletons. And I don't care what color they are. Sarah Clark, you know, fits in to this. He totally contradicted himself. You know, he wants to have Black Lives Matter listed as a threat to the civil order. But then at the same time, he's got nothing to say about White Lives Matter, which is listed as a threat to the civil order, right? He says nothing about far-right extremism. He only talks about people who complain about police brutality and racism. He has nothing to say about anything else. And he wanted to crack down. Well, he was talking about pitchforks and torches before the election when it seemed that Trump would lose, which he did lose the popular vote any goddamn way by 2.7 million votes. Go look it up. But then he wanted to crack down on every protest that came around because it doesn't seem like he really deserves this election. And then there was talk about him being Homeland Security, but he got pushed out of the way into somebody else up there. I really didn't think they were going to give it to a black guy. But then at the same time, why would they give it to a black guy like him? Because this way, when he cracks down on all the Negroes, they can just say, well, hey, it's not racial. He's black. Because that's their mentality. That's their way of explaining things. You know, I mean, that was the whole point of having black women as his media representatives and Kelly Conway to come around and put another white face on it. It's like the final layer of paint. Because this way, Katrina Pearson, was that her name, Lou? Katrina Pearson could say whatever the fuck. Well, it's not racist. Katrina Pearson's black. And who were those stupid sisters? And I'm saying sisters in a literal sense because they're siblings. But they're two black women that just talk a whole lot of fucking crap. And they're totally okay with Trump. They're okay with the fucking racism. They have nothing positive to say about black people unless they kiss ass. Now, be honest with yourself, listener, brother and sister, and whoever the fuck else is listening to this shit. Do you really think that those two women understand themselves historically as black people? As Africans? As Africans in America? Absolutely not. They are totally removed from their fucking experience. They have to be in order to say the shit that they're saying. Because no rational fucking person would say that. You know, I mean, yeah, you got a handful of Jews that we can point to historically who actively worked with the Nazis. And if you want to say accepted by them because they had a uniform, I mean, yeah, sure. You can go that far. You can do that. But, no. You know, let's just be straight the motherfucker up, man. We have to be straight the fuck up.
we're in a mass of fucking confusion. You got white people trying to find their place because somehow they don't have a place, which doesn't make any motherfucking sense. None. You know, none. I mean, they run the whole goddamn world. Everything reflects them. And to not do that even a little bit causes an interruption in their psyche that, you know, the conniptions just never stop. You know, no matter what is said or done in their favor, it's still not the fuck enough. And I would like to say it's just white people that are like that, but I really think it has to do with the human condition because, you know, Rwanda is one easy example I can point out because it's the easiest to go look up. But don't think that other groups don't do the same thing. I mean, like I said, as somebody who's mixed, you know, in the black world, I'm treated like a white boy. First because of my looks, and then because of the way I carry myself. Because let's just face facts. Why do Uncle Toms exist? I mean, I need to do a special on this. You know, why do Uncle Toms exist? We exist, you know, probably like Sherlock Clark. I mean, you can look at Sherlock Clark and tell he's just, I don't know how old he is, but he's still trying. He's trying real fucking hard to get white approval and to hurt black people for rejecting him. And I said it like that because think about this for a second, because I've gone through this. This is one of the psychological things about being black in America that would drive you crazy. That fucking, no matter what you do, no matter what your education, no matter what kind of job, no matter, you know, how many white women you manage to snag, you know, that they, you know, you will never be, it will never be enough. It'll never be enough. Even if you literally give them your motherfucking asshole, which I've known guys that have done that shit and said it still wasn't enough. In the literal sense. Okay, that's how they pick themselves up out of poverty. And see, you know, a lot of, you know, black activists, yeah, at least in the 70s, I would say, were conscious about that and knew that. Now, you motherfuckers just throw that kind of bullshit out because they don't know what else to do. So, you know, saying that something or somebody is gay or homosexual has nothing to do with actual homosexuality. They're talking about weakness. Because that's the way that they've, you know, understood a lot of this shit. Because let's just face facts. A lot of goddamn young black men, their fucking level of education comes from the prison system. Either directly or inadvertently. And we have to be fucking honest about that. And start asking ourselves, when motherfuckers want to talk about the rap game and shit, you know, what's real and what's not. I can't remember the name of it, Lou, but I told you, my wife and I was watching a Dutch hip-hop documentary. And, you know, like I said, for those of us, you know, I was in Newark, and I would go up to Newark every now and again, but I was not into rap. But, I mean, I was around it. And I'm going to tell you, man, you know, shit was a lot different back in the motherfucking day, whether people want to accept it or not. I mean, they used to wear cowboy fucking hats and big ass earrings and fringes and all that type of shit, leather fucking custom suits, you know. And then I can't remember who said it. He's one of the early DJs. Can't remember who said it, but he said, "Yeah, man, fucking Run DMC came out wearing Adidas and basically didn't wear any goddamn outfits. Looked like motherfuckers hanging on the goddamn corner, and that's true. And shit has gone in that direction ever motherfucking since. I mean." Funkadelic was being mixed with the fuck was that? That was a club in Jersey City that I used to go. They used to play. This was back in the '80s. They used to mix. The DJ was from New York. They used to mix like Funkadelic and Love Is the Message and Captain Sky and you know, a lot of Philly shit with punk. And, like the early new wave and what have you. And the crowd was kind of mixed, you know. And everybody kind of got along. I mean, it was pretty cool. There were a couple of places like that. One was in Jersey City, and I can't remember. Hoboken. The other one was in Hoboken, yeah. But that one didn't last too long. But anyway, you get what I'm saying. You know, there were bridges being made that way, right? And, you know, Jersey had its scene. New York, of course, well, you know, that was the hip hop scene, and, you know, it is what it is. But this whole gangster rap shit, I mean, you know, you gotta think about it, man. You know, how can you be a progressive black man or woman and you know, talking about, you know, bitch better have my money, you know, type of tunes, man. I mean, come on. You know, glorifying drug dealing and black people killing each other isn't exactly black power, my brother. You know, and this whole nigga shit, you know, I'm tired of it. You know, niggas with attitude had a lot to do with that getting out in the mainstream, which is not to say that that's not how we spoke to each other. I copped to that. I actually lost that shit when I timed out completely because, you know, I couldn't talk like that out there. And besides, who the fuck was I going to talk to? You know, but the bottom fucking line was when white people came around, we didn't say that kind of shit. You know, I remember being on a bus. Motherfuckers talking about, yeah, well, you know, a nigga like me, but I'm like, why is he talking like this? All these white people are sitting there trying to ignore, you know. It was after school. It was a bunch of motherfucking young, you know, ghetto kids got on the bus and shit. You know, one of those buses that went from, you know, one community to another where you could really see the line. You could really see the difference. You cross the boulevard, you could see the difference. And goddamn, you know, I was just first embarrassed, then shocked, and then angry because I knew. Because I had been around white people enough at this goddamn point. They will go home and say those fucking niggas were on the bus talking shit, calling each other niggas. Why should I respect them? And seeing it's hard to tell somebody who's black that doesn't really deal with the white world outside of work, outside of going to school, outside of having to like share an escalator in a mall or some shit, that when you act like a fucking fool, native people included, my Spanish-speaking Indian brothers and sisters included, when you act like a fucking fool and do not carry yourself with a certain level of class, do not carry yourself with a certain level of motherfucking self-respect, act uncouth because you want to be motherfucking seen and noticed. When you do this, white folks go home and say, that's how those motherfuckers act, and they judge your entire fucking group about that. And if you think, oh, well, I don't give a shit, well, you better think about that when one of you is sitting in the goddamn dock and has to face a fucking jury of 12. Think about that shit when you go to fill out an application for services, for an apartment, for a loan, and especially when it comes to getting a goddamn job. And think about that when those cops are cruising around and shit, and they just saw a fucking pack of kids acting like fucking idiots, and then they see you. Because that shit has happened to me. I had nothing to do with what the fuck else was going on. Matter of fact, yeah. Yeah, that was in the news, right, Luke? There was a black woman, she's got a, yeah, we'll close it with this. You know, she's got a video out here saying that she was in a Victoria's Secret someplace. Can't remember, I think it was in the South somewhere. On the East Coast. Eastern Seaboard, whatever the fuck you want to call it. And, a black woman was in there and they called her shoplifting. That happens. Okay, so they caught this other woman shoplifting. So they decide to walk over to another black woman who was in the store, who was shopping, who has money in her goddamn pocket and her goddamn credit cards, and they kicked her out of the store too. They just assumed that they knew each other when they didn't, and they kicked them both out because she was black. Now, ask yourself, they catch a white person shoplifting. Did they kick all the white people out the store? If they do by you, you need to let us know about it. Fourth World Radio, number 4, TH, World Radio, at gmx.pt. Email me the case. Email me and give me some more information on this. Matter of fact, come on the show, because I would like to talk about this. I want to talk to you. If you've seen that type of fucking discrimination against white people, I want to talk about it. Because I keep hearing all these white guys talking about, well, I can't get a cab because I'm white. Really? You got a story like that? Email me. You can come on the show and tell us all about it. Tell us all about how you're being discriminated against because you're white. How the cops are stopping you because you're a white male in the street. And they deem you to be dangerous. I really want to hear this. I want to hear from you. I'm going to give you a serious opportunity here to come in and explain to my listeners, all people of color, that you are a victim of racism. And I'm going to let you tell your story. Now, we're going to end it with that. You know, thanks for listening. We're going to have some audio about, I don't know, Lupe, what are you going to talk about? Well, I don't know. She's going to put something on. That'll be worth your while, I'm sure. This is the Angry Indian. Thanks for sticking around. Please, Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Zesh9 from Zesh9.com, and you're listening to the Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
By the way, are there any niggers here tonight?
What did he say? Why, is he really getting out of his nut? Are there any niggers here tonight? Is he that desperate for shock value? Are you straight the bottom bound to be that cruel to say, are there any niggers here tonight? Have I ever talked about the Schwartz and they left the room? Or the Moulin Jeans or the Yams or placated some southerner by absence of voice when he rant and raved about the niggers? Are there any niggers here? I know I'm working with a nigger. I think I see one nigger couple back there between those two niggers to three kikes. Thank God for the kikes. And two spicks and one mick. We have two spicks, one mick, three kikes, and one spunky, funky, hunky. Any more boogies? Three more sheenies, eight more guineas, six guineas, seven wops, six grease balls. I pass the six dykes, four kikes, and eight niggers. The point, if President Kennedy got on television every day and said, I would like to introduce all the niggers in my cabinet, and all the niggers called each other niggers, they oftentimes who but in front of the old phase, and every day you heard nigger, 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 in the second month, nigger would mean as much as good night or God bless you in your sneeze, or perhaps as much as I promise to tell the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help me God. Nigger would lose its impact, and it'd never make any four-year-old nigger cry when he came home from school. Zagornish gives it the power, Jim.
Don't let the colonial occupation blues get you down. Listen to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The podcast for Intelligent Aboriginals.
Hello, I'm Carol Gordon. Plan B is an emergency contraceptive that prevents pregnancy. It is not an abortion pill and does not cause an abortion, only the prevention of pregnancy. If you have had unprotected sex or have been raped and need Plan B, contact your local Indian health service. You have a legal right to receive Plan B over the counter, meaning without a prescription or a doctor's appointment if you are 17 or older. Plan B must be taken within 72 hours of sexual intercourse to be effective. For more information, call 605-487-7072. This message is brought to you by the Native American Women's Health Education Resource Center.
I'm Dick Gregory with PETA. Martin Luther King Jr. taught me the fight against oppression is never an easy one. It's even harder if you have no voice. For animals held captive in circuses, life consists of cramped cages, shackles, and daily beatings. There is no escape. They cannot demand their freedom. Images like these bring only one word to my mind, slavery. Be an abolitionist for the animals. Please don't go to circuses. For more information, contact PETA.
757-622-PETA.
Radio Insurgente, la voz de los sin voz.
Vamos, 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 vamos adelante, para que salgamos en la lucha avante, porque nuestra patria grita y necesita de todo el esfuerzo de los zapatistas.
Transmitiendo desde algún lugar de las montañas del sureste mexicano, en la frecuencia 97.9 en FM.
Nicely played. Sachin is off the mark. Who's
the man who wants to play? Say, Nikale.
Are you Neelam ko zaroor?
Neelam ko zaroor. Main kama ki raha aur tu lagti hai ki tere to. Kisi baar samjha tere ko. Mere wallet ko haath mein lagana. And jab dekho to faltu cheezon par paise kharch karti rehti ho. Are mere ke charity khol ke rakhi. Itna hi agar tere ko charity ka shauk hai to ja apne baap se le.
घरेलू हिंसा में बाधा डालकर उसे रोको। बेल बजाओ।
घरेलू हिंसा अधिनियम पर जानकारी के लिए bellbajao.org पर लॉग ऑन करें। ब्रेक थ्रू की पहल।
Hey everybody, it's Dr. Vibe, the host and producer of the Dr. Vibe Show at thedrvibeshow.com. At our show, we do conversations and provide information for black men and those who love them. So come check us out. Also at iTunes, and also selective episodes are featured at the Good Men Project, one of the most viewed websites in the world for men. So find out about black men and those who love them at the Dr. Vibe Show.
This is DJ Fusion of the Fusebox Radio Broadcast and BlackRadiosBack.com. You're now listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, another slice of real black radio for the masses. All right? Peace.
And here it is. It's not actually set to hit the newsstands until December the 19th, but Donald Trump is Time Magazine's Person of the Year. No great surprise there from a shortlist which included Vladimir Putin, our very own Nigel Farage, and Beyonce. I'm not joking. Read the script. Read the fucking news every now and then, Tim. Why is Beyonce any more ridiculous than Nigel Farage? From Destiny's Child to Satan's Knob Dribble. I mean, even without the horns, it's pretty sinister, isn't it? I mean, I get why they gave it to him. I mean, it's not necessarily an accolade, is it? I mean, they gave it to Hitler in 1938, but Nigel Farage? I don't get... Right, this is... Give that it. Right, this is how they justified giving Farage the nomination, right? Okay, here we go. As head of the UK Independence Party, depending what day of the week it is, face of the successful campaign for Britain to leave the European Union. He wasn't even part of the official leave campaign. He just took all the credit. They wouldn't let him near the official leave campaign. He was just a man on his own, travelling round the country on a bus, getting off every now and then to sample local ales. And yet, if you're outside the UK, Farage is now considered one of our most important political players on the international stage. He gets more coverage than our own Prime Minister. Which probably isn't a bad thing, considering what she gets up to when she is on the international stage. What? All right, well, what delights has she been up to this week? Because we're no longer friends with the EU, thanks, Nigel, she's jetted off to the Gulf to beg dictators to buy our weapons. It's a disgrace. You can't deny it's a fucking disgrace. Even Boris Johnson has started having a go at Saudi Arabia, and for once, he's not talking complete bollocks. But, you know, he shouldn't have said it. He shouldn't have said it. Why shouldn't he have said it? Because we sell them weapons! We sell them lots of weapons to a country where women aren't allowed to leave the country without the permission of a male relative. They're not allowed to drive. They're not allowed to wear makeup or wear clothes that show off their beauty. Presumably, that is why Theresa May is allowed in the country. Yeah, I mean, is it any wonder that people turn to cartoon characters like Nigel Farage? Because our actual politicians behave like international arms dealers. Okay, we don't trust our elected politicians to do our politics anymore. Let's not forget, the only thing Nigel Farage has ever been elected to is the very institution that he spent his career trying to destroy. Well, you've managed that, Nigel. Can you fuck off now, please? Man of the year. Jesus. Yeah, sorry, person of the year. I just find it weird referring to Farage or Trump as, you know, an actual person. Donald Trump, person of the year. I shouldn't really be surprised. Glamour magazine's woman of the year is Bono. Because what is it? Because apparently men aren't often given the consideration. But men aren't credited with being good women. Something like that. You even got Wonder Woman is a UN ambassador because there aren't any actual non-fictional women doing anything of any worth, are there? I mean, what next? Fucking Stephen Hawkins, sports personality of the year. Jesus. Ooh. Razzle. Seriously, do they still do that? You know. Well, here it is. It's not actually going to hit the newsstands until December the 19th, but Donald Trump is Time Magazine's Person of the Year.
1 week of every year is designated National Brotherhood Week. This is just one of many such weeks honoring various worthy causes. One of my favorites is National Make Fun of the Handicapped Week, which Frank Fontaine and Jerry Lewis are in charge of, as you know. During National Brotherhood Week, various special events are arranged to drive home the message of brotherhood. This year, for example, on the first day of the week, Malcolm X was killed, which gives you an idea of how effective the whole thing is. I'm sure we all agree that we ought to love one another, and I know there are people in the world who do not love their fellow human beings, and I hate people like that. Here's a song about National Brotherhood Week. Oh, the white folks hate the black folks, and the black folks hate the white folks. To hate all but the right folks is an old established rule. But during National Brotherhood Week, National Brotherhood Week, Lena Horne and Sheriff Clark are dancing cheek to cheek. It's fun to eulogize the people you despise, as long as you don't let them in your school. Oh, the poor folks hate the rich folks, and the rich folks hate the poor folks. All of my folks hate all of your folks. It's American as apple pie. But during National Brotherhood Week, National Brotherhood Week, New Yorkers love the Puerto Ricans 'cause it's very chic. Step up and shake the hand of someone you can't stand. You can tolerate him if you try. The Protestants hate the Catholics, and the Catholics hate the Protestants, and the Hindus hate the Muslims, and everybody hates the Jews. But during National Brotherhood Week, National Brotherhood Week, it's National Everyone Smile at One Anotherhood Week. Be nice to people who are inferior to you. It's only for a week, so have no fear. Be grateful that it doesn't last all year.
Hey, this is Jonathan Colton, and you're listening to a podcast released under a Creative Commons license. CC, baby. Check it out.
Hey, everybody. It's Dr. Vibe, the host and producer of The Dr. Vibe Show at thedrvibeshow.com. At our show, we do conversations and provide information for black men and those who love them. So come check us out. Also at iTunes, and also selective episodes are featured at the Good Men Project, one of the most viewed websites in the world for men. So find out about black men and those who love them at the Dr. Vibe Show.
Palestine is one of the most reported places in the world.
But there's still a lot of misinformation about the reality on the ground.
What much of the media fails to explain
is that since 1948, nearly 75% of the entire indigenous Palestinian population
have been forcibly driven off our land
to make room for the creation of the so-called State of Israel.
And we are denied the right to return to our homeland.
The remaining 25% of Palestinians live as second-class citizens in the State of Israel, or under a brutal military occupation in the West Bank and Gaza Strip.
While world powers fund and support Israel, We,
the people of the world, in our millions,
support the Palestinian people's struggle for freedom and equal rights. If
I boycott Israeli goods,
it's because I oppose an illegal occupation.
Because I oppose racism. Because I oppose brutality towards the indigenous people of their land. I reject the notion that I am anti-Semitic.
I reject the notion I'm a self-hating Jew, simply because I oppose the idea of an exclusively Jewish state.
There is only one line of division.
It's not a line of division between Muslims and Jews.
It's not a line of division between Palestinians and Israelis.
It is a line of division.
It is a line of division.
It is a line of division between those who stand for the equality of all
and those who stand for the supremacy of some. Boycott apartheid.
Boycott Israel. Boycott apartheid.
Boycott Israel.
Boycott apartheid. Boycott Israel.
Only 28% of Americans believe in evolution.
62% want creation science taught along with evolution in our schools.
44% want creation science taught exclusively.
You are all about to learn that you didn't come from monkeys and slime.
all of you were created in the image and likeness of God.
But didn't we evolve from prior organisms?
Yes, we did. Those organisms were named Adam and Eve.
Then why do we share 99% of our DNA with chimpanzees?
The Bible doesn't teach about chimpanzees.
What about redundant DNA and junk DNA? Does the Bible teach about that?
Well, I can tell you one thing. There's no redundant DNA in hell.
Our children are our future.
Let's try not to turn them into dangerous idiots.
This is FSNL reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
This is APNS Public Radio.
The opinions expressed in dispatches represent the analysis of the participating editors and may not necessarily reflect the group positions of the ANG or its public news wires.
This is Congresswoman Barbara Lee. When I'm not throwing down on the floor of Congress, looking out and fighting for your rights, I'm listening to Hard Knock Radio.
This is Danny Glover, and I want you to listen to what I listen to, Hard Knock Radio.
This is Dolores Huerta, and this is Hard Knock Radio.
This is Bobby Seale here. I'm the former chairman, founder, and the old national organizer of the Black Panther Party. The Black Panther Party was a political revolutionary organization out of the 1960s. This is Hard Knock Radio. I love Hard Knock Radio. Coming here and listening to this framework here, it's what's happening. You've got to be tuned in. And I want all people who dig Hard Knock to understand that you can do some Hard Knock work out there in the community, too.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. And there is so much to talk about. A lot of things going on. First and foremost, I think, in front of everybody, in on the top of everybody's mind, is what is going on in the Middle East with Palestine, Israel, the ceasefire that never was, and what is really driving this. And I have a very, very special guest in the building. We've heard him talk about a lot of this stuff before it was even happening. He gave a historic speech in 2008 at the Hip Hop Political Convention. We dubbed it Message to the Hip Hop Grassroots. And he talked about the rise of the fascist state. He gave an in-depth history lesson. He talked about what it would be like to live in the United States under a black president, especially a black president that holds the policies of Barack Obama. Many people at the time looked at him cross-eyed, was like, what? No, no, no. And now everybody's listening back to that speech and saying, almost everything you said has come to pass. He's a former political prisoner, Black Panther, Black Liberation Army member. We're talking about Daruba Bin Wahad. He's also the subject of a documentary, Passing It Along, Passing It On. And he is here in the building. It's good to have you in the flesh, brother. How are you?
I'm fine. It's good to be here and see you again, David.
And also joining us a little bit later on in the conversation is a scholar, activist, somebody who's an expert, especially when we talk about what is going on in world affairs. And really, she digs deep when we talk about the politics and policies out of South Africa, is Danae Martinez. And I know she has a lot to add to this. But Daruba, I wanted to kick things off with you. What is your assessment of what is going on in the Middle East? And I want to ask this question from the standpoint of the popular narrative that has been floating around in mainstream media, and we're seeing articles and columns and commentary, is that the black political class, the black civil rights movement, doesn't want to have anything to do with Palestine, that they're firmly behind Israel. We've seen that The Israeli lobby has gone on to a lot of black college campuses. They've been flying people over. We're seeing articles come out, and we're seeing that a lot of leaders who normally would speak on atrocities have been completely silent, and they've been nowhere to be seen. What is your take on this, especially with the claim that the black civil rights movement would never be in support of Palestine, since you were, I think you're part of that black liberation struggle. If anybody, you, 19 years, political prisoner, Black Panthers, what do you say about all this?
Well, I think that the silence of the black political elite and many so-called black reformists and activists is a consequence of the interference with political power on behalf of the African community. AIPAC and the Zionist lobby in Washington, and Jewish money across the country has been a major factor in historically in the civil rights movement. The NAACP was founded by leftist progressive Jews. The Communist Party that Du Bois entered and eventually broke with was dominated by Ashkenazi European Jews who had migrated to the U.S. and were part of the leftist movement. Jews in the United States have always, and for the most part, played the progressive role in trying to deal with issues of institutional racism, because they were often the times of so-called anti-Semitism and anti-Jewish attacks. They came from the old Europe, the old imperial Europe, where Zionism was born. Zionism was a reactionary nationalist response to the pogroms and hatred of Jews by Europeans, by European governments, by European cultures and peoples. Hmm. It's a construct of the Ashkenazi Jews, and it was an adjunct. It was always an instrument of imperialism. If anyone remembers or recalls the British in World War One, in after World War One, when the Ottoman Empire was divided up and divvied up, the Balfour Agreement, which was made by the then Foreign Secretary Balfour of Great Britain, he made a secret agreement with Theodore Herzl, who was one of the founding members of modern Zionism, to find a homeland within the breakup, within the now disintegrated territories of the Ottoman Empire for the Jewish people, for the Ashkenazi European Jews. It was understood that this was essentially a European settler arrangement, much like South Africa. It's a European settlement. It's a European settler strategy to place within the lands of Muslims and Arab-speaking people a European military power and force that can regulate and control the region militarily and geopolitically. A lot of folks don't understand, and I repeat this over and over again, every crisis that we have today is a consequence of injustices that happened yesterday.
Right.
And that's
a hard pill for people to swallow.
Yes. And Britain and France are directly responsible for the turmoil that we have in the Middle East today. And this can be said in whenever we look at any of these problems. It was Britain and France that established the state of Syria, the modern state of Syria after World War II. After World War One, it was the British and the French that established Lebanon and made sure that the ethnic divisions were of such a nature that there would always be a pro-Western elite that was in power. Of course, the demographics of Muslims and Christians and Falangists changed over the years, and the Muslims multiplied quicker. So that whole demography has been changed. That led to the crisis in Lebanon. We see that with the European settler state of Israel, which was a British mandate under the British after the fall of the Turkish Empire. It was a British mandate,
could we clarify what we mean by mandate? Because I think people use that word but don't really understand the particulars. It was almost like if I could use this as an example, the westward migration here in the U.S., like, we'll give you some, 40, mm-hmm. we'll give you some acreage, we'll give you some money, and all these savages, quote unquote Native Americans, you can move them out, and that will be, they don't get no rights. And was this kind of the thing that we're talking about with?
Well, sort of, but I would want to address that too in terms of us understanding white supremacy in America and the fact that African people have no wealth and that wealth accumulation is the path, of course, and the basis for political power. But that's a whole nother right. analysis. But yeah, but what I want to say was the British mandate. Okay. At the end of World War One, the victors of World War One, which was the United States, Britain, France, Belgium, the lowlands, the victors of that won that war, and I call it the first imperialist war of the 20th right. century. They won that war against the Central Powers, which were consisted of Germany, Austria, Hungary, the Balkans, much of what we know today as Lithuania. All of these, they were on the side, and the Turks, mm-hmm. they were on the losing side. And the Turkish Ottoman Empire spanned the entire Mediterranean for over 500 years. In fact, the Turkish Empire extended to the very gates of Vienna. You could ride outside of Vienna for 50 miles and you would be at the border of the Turkish Ottoman Empire.
Right.
And so when we see what happened in Herzegovina and Bosnia, this is all a consequence of the long history of Muslim domination of these regions, and that once the political order disintegrated, it turned into this vicious genocidal civil war where neighbor was killing neighbor. We can go across the world and see that, whether it was Rwanda, whether it's in the Congo, it's always been this. And the auspices of this has always been the European imperialist powers.
Where the borders are divided, so yeah, that you have.
Across cultures, across religions, across right. ethnicity. And so what I'm trying to say is Jordan, Transjordan, was a protectorate of the United, of the League of Nations. The League of Nations was an organization that was put together after World War One to ensure, quote, that there would be peace between the world powers, that there would be no more wars like World War One. It was the precursor or the predecessor to the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the Turkish Empire was divvied up, when the Ottoman Empire collapsed and the modern state of Turkey was founded, there was all of these territories in North Africa, in the Middle East, in the Far East that used to be under Turkish rule that were no longer under Turkish rule.
Right.
The Turks were not Arabs, are not Arabs. But most of their territories that they administratively controlled under the caliphate were Arab nations. The predominant people were Africans and Arabs. And so when the Turkish Empire was disintegrated, the British, mainly the British and the French, were given certain territories to administer until the peoples in those territories could find some form or some manner of self-determination. So the British control of Palestine was an administrative control of the Palestinian territory in the Middle East.
Mm.
Okay. Conferred by the League of Nations. Of course, the League of Nations failed in its job to stop another war. They allowed Abyssinia or Ethiopia to be invaded by the Italians and did nothing. They allowed the Japanese to annex Manchuria and invade parts of Southeast Asia and did nothing. So the League of Nations collapsed. And then World War II came along. And it was in that interim between World War I and World War II that the former imperial powers, in order to thwart Germany's access to oil and access to that region, began to recruit European Jews into different military brigades. The British had a whole brigade of Zionists, a whole brigade of European Jews who fought in World War II. And they were repatriated to the territories that the so-called legal mandate territories.
Okay, so that's how that mandate breaks down then.
Yeah, the mandate broke down with the end of World War II and the enormous amount of sympathy that was had in the world for the Holocaust, for the murder of millions of non-Germans, Jews and Roma people and gays and leftists and all of those peoples that the Nazis killed, but mainly the because the Zionist movement
Go ahead.
Because the Zionist movement at that time, during World War II, the Zionist movement was part and parcel of the Allied effort to liberate Nazi-occupied Europe.
Right.
And so they managed to parlay that vacuum after World War II into a state.
Right.
If you know, there's a movie coming out called Exodus.
Right.
And it's going to glorify and show how the Zionist movement manipulated the sympathies of the world after World War II to find the modern state of, to establish the modern state of Israel. So Israel is essentially a European settler state. It's a construct of Europe after World War II. It has nothing to do with the Palestinians in any other fashion than that.
Right.
The settlers in Israel are not indigenous to that land. They are almost all European. They are Ashkenazis as opposed to Sephardic Jews. They are racist. And this is expressed in their policies and in their treatment of Ethiopian and non-Jews of color. It's a settler state. So when you have a situation like Gaza, where Obama and the U.S. government and their Israeli supporters come forth and say Israel has a right to defend itself, and that Hamas or these organizations like Hamas don't recognize Israel's right to exist, that right there is telling you that Israel existentially, as a European settler state, has to have its existence legalized, recognized, regularized by everybody. And because they're on a people's land and they've been annexing this land illegally in violation of hundreds of UN declarations, they've been establishing the settlements, they've been expanding settlements, they've been building walls to create dividing Palestinians from Israelis to create on the ground the impossibility of a Palestinian state. And so when Hamas's recognition of Israel is irrelevant, because Israel is a fait accompli in terms of its military power. It is what it is. It is there already. Whether that's like telling me if someone comes into your living room and says, well, look, you know, this house was given to me by God, before you moved in, and this living room is mine, but I'm going to let you live in the attic. You understand? And you could stay in the attic and you could use the kitchen when I'm not using it. But, you know, this is my house and you need to recognize that this is my house. Now, of course, you who've been, delegated to the attic, you're never going to recognize that as their house.
Right.
But now if they got all the power and the strength and there's nothing you physically can do about it, you have to recognize the fact that they're there.
You can't deny.
Okay. So it's a false notion that the Palestinians have to recognize Israel's right to exist, and that if they don't recognize Israel's right to exist, then therefore they're a terrorist organization and Israel has a right to defend themselves. No settler state has a right to defend stolen territory. No settler state it should be immune from resistance of the people whose land was stolen from them. So the whole paradigm of the dialogue has been twisted so that we in the West, who support Israel to the tune of billions of dollars a year in military aid, in economic aid, are believing that we're supporting a democracy of people just like us in a region where people are trying to take women back to the 19th, to the 12th century. And these are some, crazy terrorists who don't want to live in peace. That's not the dialogue at all. And we need to understand that even if a ceasefire was to morph into a longer peace negotiation, we're going to revisit the same contradiction probably in the next few months, if not in the next year or so.
Right. If you're just tuning in, that's the voice of Daruba Ben-Wahad giving a serious history lesson. And we promised that we were going to be dwelling deep into history. And it's really important that Daruba is giving this because he is an African. And the claim has been that Africans don't know what's happening on the Middle East. And if they do, they're siding with Israel. And I want to have you address that issue in a second. Before we go, I need to let people know that Daruba Ben-Wahad will be among a number of people that will be speaking, if they will be paying tribute tonight at 6 o'clock to Yuri Kuchimama, Kuchiyama. This is a special event that's going to be taking place at the old holdout, now known as Quilombo. That is on San Pablo. And I forget the address. You have the address on you? 2313 San Pablo Avenue. Hannibal in the building, standing in the cuts, giving us the address. We appreciate that. So 2313 San Pablo Avenue. Doors open at 6. Number of people going to be there. Daruba will definitely be throwing down. صباح الخير يا ولاد عمومنا تفضلوا شرفونا شو بتحب مضيفكم دم عربي ولا دموع من عيوننا بعتقد هيك تأملوا نستقبل من هيك تعقدوا لما تدركموا على غلطة من هيك لبسنا الكوفي البيضة والسودة صاروا كلاب الزمان يلبسوها كمودة مهما تفننوا فيها مهما غيروا بلونها كوفية عربية بتضل عربية حطتنا بدنا اياه ثقافتنا بدنا اياه كرامتنا بدنا اياه كل شي إلنا بدنا اياه نسكت لن نسمح لن ليك ليك لا بقلن يسرقوا شغلة مش إلهم ما خصم فيه بيقلدونا بتلبس لبس هالأرض بكفيهن طمعانين عالقدس قدس اعرفوا كيف يكونوا بشر وغصب عن أبوهم هي حطتنا من هيك لبسنا الكوفي لأنها وطنية الكوفي كوفي عربي من هيك لبسنا الكوفي هويتنا الأساسية الكوفي كوفي عربي يلا علم كوفي علولي هالكوفي الكوفي كوفي عربي علوه هلا بلاد الشام كوفية عربية بتضل عربي ما في بعد مثل الشعب العربي فرجوني أي أمي بالدنيا أكتر مؤثري الصورة واضحة نحن محد الحضارة تاريخنا وتراثنا الشاهد على وجودنا من هيك لبست الثوب الفلسطيني من حفا جنين جبل النار إلى رام الله خليني شوف الكوفية البيضة والحمرة خلينا نعليها لفوق بالسما أنا هجاه دية العرب الثاني بهز غزة الثاني بهز هزكلي ماتي حرب سجل أنا شاد يا منصور والحطة هويتي من يوم ما خلقت سيدي والشعب مسؤوليتي لكن اتربيت بين الغرب وبين الشرق بين لغتين بين بخيل بين فقير شفت الحياة من الشقتين أنا مثل الكوفية كيف ما لبستوني وين ما شلحتوني بضلني عوصولي فلسطينية من هيك لبسنا الكوفية لأنها وطنية الكوفية كوفية عربي من هيك لبسنا الكوفية هويتنا الأساسية الكوفية كوفية عربي يلا علم كوفية علولي هالكوفية الكوفية كوفية عربي علوه هلا بلاد الشام كوفية عربية بتضل عربية
statement. Disgustingly, I spit on the pavement. It's basic. Y'all know I bang for my flag. My bandana ain't no rag. The kafia ain't no scarf. It's a part of the movement. The symbolism is resistance. No coincidence that you can see the RBG in it. Cable neat the bandana. Ain't it beautiful? I say it in Spanish. It's solidarity. The feelings is mutual. Meanwhile, hot, that's M1 in Arabic. I'm pro-Falastini, does that make me a terrorist? You can catch me in Gaza, in Haifa or Ramallah, but I'm still just Mutulu Olubala. So when I rap with Shaja, we rhyme with our middle fingers up to the Zionists, cause we don't give a fuck. Oh, it's justice. So tie that thing around your head and ride. Wave it in the air and let me know what side you want. Uhuru, yeah. The kafir is Arab. Yeah, it's M1. Solidarity, feel me, Shaja. Do it. From the ghetto to Gaza. I keep it RBG up. Yeah.
This whole thing where we're for my flag. Having this claim that African Americans have been, you know, siding with the Zionists. We see them actually saying that. We've seen these articles coming out and there's heavy recruitment going on black college campuses by AIPAC and others to bring students alongside to make these claims. We just had Ziggy Marley say, you know, I'm going to Israel, this is my homeland, and yada, yada, yada. He signed, siding with the Zionists. We've seen Alicia Keys pop over. We've seen complete silence from people who've been speaking out on everything except this. And they're saying that, you know, the civil rights, there's been this claim, like, how dare the Palestinians reference the civil rights movement or the Black Power movement when, you know, they have nothing to do with this. And I wanted to ask you this because there have been these long parallels in conversations, you know, with the Black liberation struggle in Palestinians. Can you speak on that? And then you jump in because you understand it from the South African perspective. But I'll start off with you, Daruba.
Well, you know, in 1966, when Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale founded the Black Panther Party right here in Oakland, California, in October 1966, the party went from a local organization that was basically dealing with police brutality and white supremacy in the police force here in the Oakland and the Bay Area, to a national organization that began to embrace the issues that affected Black people globally. The Black Panther Party evolved into essentially a pan-African nationalist organization over in less than 2 years, and during the course of that evolution, the Black Panther Party reached out to revolutionary movements around the world, especially liberation movements in Africa, and in Cuba. The Black Panther Party established a delegation in Cuba. It was comprised mainly of Panther exiles who are being pursued by law enforcement in this country. Eldridge Cleaver, then the Minister of Information of the Black Panther Party, first went to Cuba and got political asylum. Because of the politics of the counterintelligence program and the attempts to turn Black organizations against each other, Kwame Ture, or Stokely Carmichael, wound up traveling to Algeria and initially for a Pan-African cultural festival. And it was through those relationships, those cultural relationships with other liberation movements, that we wound up establishing a consulate in North Africa and Algeria. Mm. Now, we need to understand that at the time that the Panther Party established this consulate in Algeria, in Algiers, Algiers was a hotbed of the liberation struggles of the world. Mm. There were representatives from every movement around the world, the NLF, the PFLP, the PLO.
And this is history that's been erased.
Oh, it's been erased by the same Negroes right now who are endorsing Israel. I was coming to that, but you leaped ahead of this. So at that time, when the Panther Party had established its consulate in Algiers, it was enjoying an immense amount of goodwill, and it established concrete relationships with the ANC, the PAC, the PAIGC, Frelimo, the Congolese Liberation Forces, the FLN, and as I stated over again, the Palestinians. And this led to an ongoing relationship. So in 68, myself in New York, I was one of the cadre, one of the Panthers who was in charge of the liaison with the Palestinian contingent at the United Nations here. The Panther Party had a concrete relationship with the Palestinian liberation struggle.
Wait a second. Can you just say this slowly? Because now we need to hear this real clear. This is for all these folks that have been walking around saying, how dare the Palestinians, blah, 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 right? Can you repeat what you're just saying? Because we need to know this history.
Well, this relationship, this is what I was going to say, this relationship with the PLO, with the PFLP, you understand? This is when the United States did not recognize the PLO or the PFLP or the Palestinians as a legitimate liberation movement. They didn't recognize them. And the United States was involved in the war in Vietnam at that time. And if you recall, if you go back to the Black Panther Party newspapers, the old ones, you'll see that there were articles in there where our delegation had actually visited Beirut. And was taking on a tour of the Palestinian refugee camps. The Panthers offered to help the Palestinians in terms of political support and propaganda support. In fact, in Palestine, there arose the Black Panther movement in Palestine amongst the Palestinians who were emulating the Black Panther Party in the United States because they felt that the PLO and the PFLP were not militant enough. Okay? And the same is true when we look at across the board at a lot of other movements. When we talk about the ANC in South Africa, when we talk about Tambo and Mbeki, these were all people who came through Algiers, who had residences in Algiers, who were meeting on a daily and a regular basis with the Panther Party. In fact, the Algerian government used to use the Black Panther Party's delegation in Algiers to meet and greet and host people from the African diaspora from Europe and the United States. Mm. The Panther delegation was one of the few movements in Algeria that could openly carry arms in the security apparatus. So we've always had a relationship, an international relationship with liberation movements, and especially with, like I said, the Palestinians and with the North Koreans and with the NLF. If you go back to the old documents in the Panther paper, you'll see that the FBI was worried about how Huey Newton had offered to send troops, offered to send cadre to help fight with the NLF against the U.S. forces that were occupying South Vietnam at that time. Mm. And they were very concerned about that. They were very concerned about the interaction between the Black Panther Party and the Palestinian Front for the Liberation of Palestine under George Habash. So we've always had an international relationship with the liberation movements in Africa and in Asia and in the Middle East. And this always troubled the U.S. government, and especially troubled them when Martin Luther King came out and condemned the war in Vietnam and started to identify U.S. imperialism and U.S. actions abroad as the major purveyor of violence in the world. Now, you got to remember, there's a history here. It was the United States that overthrew the first democratically elected government in Iran that they're talking about now should be embargoed. It was the United States that sent the battleship Iowa off the coast of Lebanon and bombarded the Shouf Mountains in support of the phalangist's attempt to neutralize Yasser Arafat and the PLO in Lebanon. They believed that Lebanon had become a Palestinian state. The Israelis invaded Lebanon in order to kick out the PLO. The PLO went in exile to where? They went in exile to Tunisia, to North Africa. Okay? So when we look at the destabilization of North Africa recently, Gaddafi, all of these incidents, all of these things have been connected in U.S. policy for years. We know that the same Negroes in Atlanta, the sitting right down there now in Atlanta, who are silent on Zionism, some of them Negroes were in the Carter administration, like Andrew Young, and were fired from their position because they sought reconciliation with the Palestinian people and the Palestinian issue. The Jews in AIPAC made sure that Carter fired his Secretary of State, which was Andrew Young at that time, for meeting secretly and without his authorization with PLO representatives. So there's a history of African people in the United States supporting the rights of the Palestinians to self-determination and opposing the European settler state of Israel. And the United States government in its COINTELPRO operations saw that. They had a whole operation called Operation Jaime or something, some racist name, in which they sent letters around to black Jewish organizations saying that the Black Panther Party were, the Black Panthers were anti-Semites, they were Nazis, and that they were, and that liberal Jews were supporting them. They blacklisted Leonard Bernstein, the head of the Philharmonic Orchestra in New York, because he held a support rally for the Panther 21 in his house.
And you were part of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so we understand that the United States government has always carried out a policy to divide black leaders in the black community away from the struggles of people for self-determination and liberation, and especially Arab and Palestinian people. And it has become successful now because we have a black leadership and a black comprador class and black elected officials whose whole format, entire funding, comes from the Israeli Zionist lobby and the right wing in America. So they don't represent black people.
We've been talking to Daruba Ben-Wahad. He's going to be speaking tonight at 2231 San Pablo Avenue, starting at 6 o'clock at a place called Colombo, or Quilombo, and that is the old holdout. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take a break. I'm going to have... 2313. I'm glad Hannibal's in the building right here, standing in the back to make sure I have my information. 2313, Quilombo, that's starting at 6 o'clock. What we're going to do is take a break. I'm going to come back and have Danaya make this other connection. In the meantime, y'all just hold tight.
Yeah. Sounds all we need is a spark. Set it over.
That's what they all yelling, but it's gangster nation. No bankers that be selling our future on the politicians. Sit back thinking about the next move to slay the next million on the backs of our children. I'm wrong for telling the story so good that it's never selling. No more lies, I can find time in the minds of my sisters while we strive to survive and realize the lies and pictures of our future. Lights are dimmer underneath the shadow they cast and leaving us without dinner. While we all gotta be strapped against the wall, no illegal sight, that's why we stressing to war. Yo, we bring heat tonight, you'll hear the call. And my suggestion is you heed the call. Occupy government, ain't no either or. We are the ones we've been waiting for. Free, not defined by what I have or what I give to my community and humanity. I'm free, I know my identity and really don't care what you think of me. I'm free, live my dreams with no fear, impossibilities, cause I know they ain't there. I'm free, ain't nobody I can find the streets this way, nothing ever could be taken from me.
Hard Knock Radio. If you're just tuning in, we've been talking with former political prisoner, freedom fighter, Daruba Ben-Wahad. You know him from the Panther 21. You know him from his documentary, Passing It Along. You know him for speaking truth to power and never letting up, and just giving us an incredible history lesson about the formation of the State of Israel, the historic connections between the Palestinians and the Black Liberation movements, which are being categorically denied and erased from history as we speak. And I'm glad that you were able to set the record straight, not as somebody who was a spectator, but as he said, he was the liaison. He was the man that was talking to the folks. So there you are. You know, can't deny your truth. Danae, I wanted to bring you in because, you know, South Africa, you live there. This is your area of expertise. And we know the long relationship that former President Nelson Mandela had with them. But I wanted to bring this up because a lot of times we hear people say, well, what have they ever done for Black people? What have the Palestinians ever done? Why are we helping them all the time? And maybe you can shed some light on that, as well as looking at the parallels as to what was happening with apartheid in 1948 as we were forming the State of Israel around the same time.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple things. According to African, you know, in Africana studies and all of that, when we're talking about African people, we've always had a sense of humanity and helping other people, regardless of whether they helped us or not. So right. To me, that's not a valid argument.
Tit for tat thing.
Right? We stand on the side of justice either way. And so when you're bombing little children, I don't care who you are, I'm going to have a problem with that, right? And then on top of it, when you're talking about African movements who've had settler colonies come in on them, such as South Africa, much very similar, I would say, as the Israeli movement, then of course there are direct parallels there. Mm-hmm. And there's even connections with the apartheid government and Zionists as well, but I'm not going to go into that. But
There's a documentary we have called Roadmap to Apartheid.
Yeah, well, yeah,
that breaks the whole thing down.
Yeah, because you know the whole nuclear program. The Israel is the only Middle East country that has a nuclear arsenal that nobody wants to talk about, and their nuclear arsenal was developed in conjunction with South Africa. And South Africa had to vow to give up it when it, when black folks took over, they had to vow to give up its nuclear program. Israel has not even mentioned its nuclear program is not even mentioned.
So, and to even add to that, what many people don't know is when South Africa, Mandela, and different people within the South African government decided to negotiate with the South African government, like the Southern African government at the time, the white government. When they decided to do that, who were they reporting to every single time they made a policy? It was Oppenheimer. People from like different Zionist organizations, they were those policies that were made that have kept South Africa basically in a apartheid state economically and in every other way and kept all the resources in white hands. Those policies were checked off. It was Mandela and Mbeki who were taking those policies to other people to be made sure that that was okay. So let's be clear. Okay. Even though the ANC was as a group was in cahoots supported PLO and outwardly supports them.
But I think that that's important. I don't want to cut you off, but I think it's important for people to understand that the ANC was never a national liberation movement.
Right.
It started out as a bunch of lawyers who wrote the Freedom Charter and who wanted equal rights for Africans in the state of South Africa.
Right.
They were not about the liberation of South Africa from imperialism and from the hold of European finance capital.
Right.
And Nelson, and this is true because, you know, I talk with people like Hugh Masekela and other folks. You know, Nelson Mandela, a year before he got out of prison, met extensively with the leaders of finance capital in England.
Right.
And this is what
I guess you're confirming what Danae has always been telling me. She pulled me to the side and said, you know, he's been, you know, so can you finish breaking some of this down?
Well, yeah, I think just to lead off on that as well, you know, people don't know that Mandela was put into a different, I don't even know if you want to call it a prison, but a 2-bedroom house with a cook and a pool before he was released. And at which time many people were coming to visit him, including the World Bank, including Finance Capital. Right. And what the Mandela movie doesn't show is if you remember that scene in the Mandela movie where he's sitting down and he's talking to them and he says, I will give up nothing. That's not true. And he says it in his own words.
That's right.
He actually said, I basically give up. I will keep it a capitalist, open, free market economy in order to continue doing what they were doing.
Let me ask you, did he have no choice in the matter, or was this something that was, you know, as long as you let me in the club, I'll go along with this type of deal?
Well, I think there's a couple things to consider when you're thinking about that. Number one, as he said, Mandela wanted to be part of the current order. When they weren't let in, that's when stuff started to jump off and when they said, we're going to have this revolution. The people, now Mandela was in prison for 25 years, right? A lot of stuff happened in South Africa while he's in there and while the rest of the ANC leadership is in exile. And at that time, in the 80s, people got more radical. And even the South African Freedom Charter is not the most radical one. Actually, the Program of Action was even more radical and is the reason why the PAC broke off, right? Because they wanted to say South Africa is for everybody, and PAC was like, well, no, Africa's for the Africans, right? And so he was never really what some would call, I would say, somebody who wanted to take back stolen land or a revolutionary in the first place, okay? But when he couldn't get what he wanted, that's when he became radical and goes into those types of things. Now, one thing I would say is, can a prisoner negotiate for a whole country? I don't think you have the power to do that.
Right.
And me being, even a human, and I'm in prison, right? They're taking him out on visits to see the ocean. They've isolated him from the other people in his government who actually, or in his organization, who actually did not support him, negotiating. And the linchpin, which Mandela says himself in his own book, he asked for the, negotiation, not them, right? And so he asked for those negotiations. So, but on the other hand, he was a prisoner, and I don't want to disrespect that in any way.
Well, I'm glad you're giving this history lesson. I think what stands out for a lot of people is the famous town hall meeting with Nelson Mandela
in New York City on the stage, Madison Square Garden, I think it might have been, with Ted Koppel, one of the people from Nightline, and is talking. And they're asking him about his relationship with Castro, his relationship with Arafat and the Palestinians. And that's where he makes the famous statement, these people supported us.
Right.
You know, these are our friends. There's no way we will turn our back on it. And that's where people make that connection, like, oh, you know, these folks had his back. So can we get some historical accuracy about how that relationship pans out? Because you're giving us the backstory, you know, that doesn't show up on TV.
DeRuba's
speaking here.
Let me say this. This is something that a lot of folks don't understand, that in the broader sense of the issues here, whether it's South Africa, whether it's the Congo, whether it's North Africa, in the broadest sense of this issue here, the decolonization of Africa, the struggles for Africa's decolonization occurred within the context of the so-called Cold War. And the Cold War was the overarching factor in all of this. It sidetracked the liberation process in most of the African countries. The liberation movements that came to power had to deal with the realities of the Cold War and Cold War politics. So most of the liberation movements in Africa were supported by the Soviet Union and China and the enemies of Western imperialism and capitalism. Now, we have to understand that the Cold War was a false dichotomy. It was a false struggle. It was a struggle that was created after World War II to empower the military, to empower the corporate elites and finance capital globally. The Soviet Union at the time, at the end of World War II and all through the Cold War, was the second largest producer of gold in the world outside of South Africa. If they wanted to destroy capitalism, they could have dumped all of that gold onto the international market, and that would have been the end of the U.S. dollar. That would have been the end of the currencies in Europe. They didn't do it because it was a false dichotomy. It was about controlling the resources of the planet and creating a new age of imperialism, a new age of Western domination and control of the world. And what the curve that was thrown is that after the Cold War, as the Cold War went down, as this struggle between East and West became less and less non-sectarian, that the rise of Islam, the natural Ummah, the international, the rise, the only force left to oppose imperialism internationally were Muslims. And people think that Muslims, the majority of Muslims, are Arab. They're not. The majority of Muslims actually are in the East, are in Indonesia and in the East. Arabs are not the majority of Muslims in the world. Okay. But their area, those Muslim lands are strategic to transportation and access of in and out of strategic minerals and resources. So the liberation process in Africa was always within the context of the Cold War. Having said that, when we look at Mandela then, when we look at the liberation of South Africa, there's two economies, actually three, but two major geopolitical economies on the African continent that drive the politics of the Western Africa, and that's Egypt and South Africa. Those are the two largest economies. Egypt sits at the access to the Suez Canal and moving over three quarters of the world's energy producing stuff through the Red Sea and so forth. The Mediterranean has always been of extreme importance to Europe. And in fact, if we go back to Tripoli and the Barbary pirates, we see that all of these forces were part of the Ottoman Empire and part of them holding Europe to hostage. But I don't want to go off on that.
Right.
What I'm trying to point out is South Africa. The reason why Nelson Mandela had to do what he did and did what he did was because South Africa was important to the global economy of the West and institutional finance capitalism. And that the South African struggle was the only struggle at that particular point in time that had a possibility of overthrowing this oligarchy and this regime, because black people were the majority population. They weren't a minority struggling for independence. They were the majority population. And if that situation degenerated into armed struggle, as it should have degenerated into, if it would have generated into armed struggle, there would have been no power sharing. There would have been no more De Beers. There would have been a natural a nationalization of those resources. And that could not happen. And Nelson Mandela was the historical person at that point that understood not only their interests and that, but understood that it was to him, to his mind, very important that the state of South Africa don't collapse in order to deliver the promise of the ANC to the majority of African people. Of course, we know he was wrong. We know it was a serious mistake. And you see that with the murder of the miners shot down by agents of the state.
Right.
Several years ago.
Let me ask you this. And this gets to be a touchy situation, and anybody can weigh in on this. But the other argument has been made that there's Arab anti-black racism that exists, and therefore we should not support these people. You know, there's still slavery in the continent, and it's controlled by Arabs. So why should we care? And people will make the argument that we need to side with Israel because, you know, they're the ones to oppose that. And maybe somebody can break this down. Well, because this is a common thing, you know, and you know,
a misconception.
Okay. You want to get a shot at it first?
Go ahead.
I would say there's anti-black racism within many different groups. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that we let Palestinian children get bombed. I don't care. Right. And we've always had a sense of social justice, of standing for people and social justice. So even if, and we know the anti-black racism because of settlers exists everywhere. Right. It exists everywhere. You don't get away from it.
Right.
So I just think that's an erroneous argument, but I'll defer to him.
OK, but let me say this. And this, again, goes back into historical context. At the end of World War II. The former imperial powers of France, Britain, Italy, and all, they lost their colonies.
Mm-hmm.
So they went back to these territories and tried to reassert their colonies and try to reassert their dominance. That's how we got sucked into Vietnam with the French. The French tried to reestablish their power in Southeast Asia. Couldn't happen. Okay. Everybody tried to the British tried to reestablish themselves in Nigeria and in Ghana. And then we know the end result was Ghanaian independence, the struggles in South, in okay. With the Arabs of North Africa, the history of imperialism in that region has always came up against the empires of Islam. It was the empires of Islam from the very early days of the last crusade that kept European influence and power at bay in North Africa, that stopped them from infiltrating into cultures and regions and taking them over the same way they did in sub-Saharan Africa. Okay. Now, it's very important to understand this, because what arose out of this struggle and out of the struggle against the Turks and at the end of World War II, you know, we all know about Lawrence of Arabia and all that stuff. What arose out of this was a distinct Arab nationalism, an anti-imperial Arab nationalism. And one of the foremost leaders of this movement were people like Ben Bella and Nasser and these different individuals. And they overthrew the imperialist stooges who were in their country. These were princes and these knuckleheads that they had that was serving at the behest of the British and the French and the Italians. They overthrew them and they established these pan-Arab regimes. These pan-Arab regimes were not anti-black or anti-African. They were anti-imperialist. They were anti-European. Okay. In fact, Nasser was one of the biggest allies of Kwame Nkrumah, Enyerere, Modibo. He was one, Ben Bella. These were all founding members of the non-aligned movement.
Mm.
Okay? So originally Pan-Arabism was anti-racist. It was anti-European. What happened in the process with the annexation of Lebanon, with the overthrow of Nasser, with what we've seen happen in the 1950s and 1960s with the installation of these autocratic regimes that would get on the payroll with the British and the Italians. We know all about that. What happened is that Pan-Arabism, which was used, which was supposed to be a bulwark against European imperialism, was turned in on itself against black people, against Africans, against non-Muslims. It was turned in on itself by these same elites. Okay. So what we see today is a response from us who have a history of both the European slave trade and the Arab slave trade. We tend to equate and lump them both together. They both were fundamentally different. It's not to say a slave in is a slave, but when we look at sex trafficking today, when we look at slavery today, we don't say sex trafficking is part of capitalism. We say that sex trafficking is a crime committed by criminals, right, as if it occurs in a vacuum. But without modern capitalism, you wouldn't have sex trafficking. Without modern capitalism, you wouldn't have modern slavery. But nobody attaches this to capitalism. Mm. So, but what we see here and happens in Africa is black folks here in the United States who believe that skin color determines everything, you understand, are baffled when they go to Africa and they see black oppressors of black people. The Tuaregs of Northern Africa and Mali, who initiated the rebellion in Mali, they're Muslims and they're blacker than me and you.
Right.
And they speak Arabic.
And a lot of people don't know that.
Okay,
you know.
The Janjaweed who were murdering Africans in the Sudan and who were the agents of these Arab potentates, they were blacker than me and you. Okay? So people think that this is the case. It's not the case. The case is that you have black enemies of black people, that you have black exploiters of black people, the same way you have Arab exploiters of Arab people. And white supremacy and its agents and its allies play on that. So when we turn around and we say, well, why should we support these Arabs? They don't like us. Yeah, I know. I traveled through Egypt. I traveled through Tunisia. I know how racist them Arabs are. But when you step up in their grill and they realize you're from the South Bronx, they understand that there's a limit to that crap. Okay? It's your attitude. It's the way you deal with them. They have been accustomed to dealing with African people who were powerless. They've been accustomed to dealing with Africa that was supine in the face of imperialism. Okay? So we are dealing with a historical situation on the ground that has more to do with the history of those regions than it does with us in the diaspora and our relationship to white supremacy. We understand white supremacy completely different. We understand white supremacy from the position of the former slave. They understand white supremacy from the position of the former colonized. The colonial mentality and the slave mentality, although similar, are very different. And if you reread Fanon, you would see that there's a very serious difference between being a chattel slave and not knowing your history, and knowing your history and having your language and living on the land and having absolutely no power.
Daruba Ben-Wahad, man, giving us a serious history lesson. We're going to have to get ready to close out, and I have like 50 other questions to ask you. And Danae, I appreciate you coming in and adding to this conversation. As we close out, any last comments, you know, for people listening, for people watching on this topic that we've been talking about that we should take away?
I mean, I think the first thing to take away from listening to Brother Daruba is, like, you need to know your history in order to even have a real analysis of what we're talking about, right? And that's what consistently gets left out within global media and even now on social media to a certain extent, right? That's the number one thing, I think.
So we're caught up in symbolism.
Right, and we're caught up in just, you know, the top five reasons, you know, top five reasons, blah, 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 right? That's number one. And we have to do the deeper research, not believe what's on the TV, like the deeper research, like really look into things to know that our heroes are put up there for a reason, and villains are put there for a reason as well. And then the last thing really is that, as he said, African people and black people have always stood with the PLO and Palestinian people, and that hasn't changed. For the most part, when you talk to people, the people that I usually run with, both in South Africa and the United States, it's hands down. We stand with them. We do not stand with any settler colonies, including Israel, and especially Israel. And Israel is systematically also attacking the Africans within Israel as well.
And that's a whole other thing. And we've done shows on that. So as we're speaking, you know, talk to some black folks in Israel.
Are very connected, and they've always been connected.
Daruba Ben-Wahad, man. History that we need to have. We appreciate you coming in. Any last comments that you want to leave with us as we have less than a minute?
Well, like I said to you on the phone, our major struggle right now is with our own leadership, is with black elected officials who find it more important to get funding and money and support from forces that are hostile to us. And we see that over and over again. We see Bloomberg, former mayor, fly to Israel in support of Israel. Do you think Martin Luther King would have been silent with women and children being murdered in the streets and by Israeli bombs and tanks? No, there is a moral crisis amongst black leadership. They're punks, they're cowards, they're opportunists, they're illiterate historically, and they're arrogant. And the most the most devastating or dangerous or pernicious thing is an arrogant, ignorant MF. Okay, so what we have to really do is we have to challenge our leaders to represent our interests. Our interest is in the Palestinians being getting justice. Our interest is in people of color being treated with dignity and humanity. And finally, I just want to say, if you think there's no relationship between what's happening in Palestine and black folks being killed in the streets by the NYPD, take this into consideration. The NYPD, the New York City Police Department, has a liaison office in Tel Aviv.
Yes, they do.
And they have an open liaison, and it's got NYPD in there. They have an open liaison office in Tel Aviv. And as we speak right now, there's over 2,000 American citizens fighting in the Israeli Defense Force, killing Palestinians. These are 2,000 Americans, your neighbors, your people. Some of them are cops that took leaves of absence to join the Israeli police force to kill Palestinians. Now, when them knuckleheads come back here and kill your son, or when them SWAT teams rush in and murder your grandmother by accident, what are you going to say? There's no connection between the military police state of the United States and the military settler state of Israel. There's no connection whatsoever. Then you, the chickens have came home to roost, like Malcolm would say.
Daruba Ben-Wahad, breaking it down. Danaya Martinez, scholar, activist. We appreciate y'all coming in. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Metaphor for this. Lyrics depart, my lips paint you a self-portrait. My people make it out of Auschwitz in order to become my own oppressors. Present situation is torturous. A fortress is built 25 feet tall, thickness 5 feet of concrete, apartheid wall. It's called a security fence, but all I see as far as the eye stretches are superiority complex. A new dawn and awakening. Eyes wide open to the lies spoken, paper thin, no lifetime's frozen. Keep changing, no faking a plane, pretend I'm hoping to step outside without choking. I'm breaking wind from factory smoke, this is sulfur, not cess. Schools closing chapters, getting ulcers from the stress. Breathing that gives you asthma is hazardous to your health. Just to be an inhabitant in the city where you rest is a quest for the spirit of resistance. You can hear it in the distance if you listen, persistence. So what we fighting for? The day where you ain't even gotta fight no more. And that's the vision risen up, the heights we soar. I hope I opened up a can of worms for all these anecdotes, cause you can never candy coat the truth. And once you know it proof, then you can't ignore. You'll share your equipment with this handy quote. At the risk of sounding ridiculous, true revolutionaries got it by feeling to love. Give 100%, demolish buildings and spilling civilian blood. Collective punishment, but you know what I meant, a new dawn. Sun rising on the horizon, it's a new day. Every opportunity lies in the crisis. I'm giving this my all when I write this. We in it for the long haul, no compromise. Ready like Helen to tell him I want a divorce. Send a wedding vows and promise to protect and serve. But we battered wives and even get respect we deserve. Increased police presence, adolescents get sentenced as felons, and there's never no preventative measures to help us change the conditions. Respectfully, without putting the life on the line for this industry of referee. There's a discrepancy of good cop, bad cop. Every cop operates when injustice is the backdrop. So for the have-not, survival is padlocked. Inside of the jackpot, we rip it in the shreds. Ask what came first, the chicken and the egg. Well, they both foul and rotten. Laws, politicians, the plot, them and the cops on patrol. Keep us locked in parole, man. They all getting cold and they stop to soak. Apathy's not an option for all the lessons in life that you learn. We not stopping till we get in the right of return. To all the Zionists denying this, listen. It's a new dawn, sun rising on the horizon. It's a new day. Every opportunity lies in the crisis. Giving this my all when I write this. We in it for the long haul, no compromise. Two revolutionaries guided by feelings of love. Give 100%. Violence and buildings and spilling civilians' blood. Collective punishment. This ain't no isolated incident. We'll be right back.
Voices Indigenous Radio brings to you the basics of how not to violate the law and presents the people who are fighting the war against Mother Earth. We bring the awareness of a different paradigm to the airwaves of WBAI as we shed the same old systematic paradigm that is killing Mother Earth. And you can hear the perspective of Indigenous peoples throughout the world and how they live with the law, land, air, and water. First Voices Indigenous Radio is produced in the studios of WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming and archived on WBAI.org and FirstVoicesIndigenousRadio.org.
Hi, this is Tom Hartman. What country comes to mind when you hear the following? Protesters confined to fenced-in so-called free speech zones. The government illegally spying on citizens and producing phony news reports. People imprisoned without charge or access to a lawyer. Prisoners tortured and killed. And an illegal war launched on the basis of lies in which illegal weapons are used against civilians, journalists, and hospitals. We like to think of countries other than our own when we think of such crimes being committed. But the responsibility to call a halt to such abuses of power always lies with the citizens of the government involved. In this case, that is to say, with us, whether we like it or not. The United States Constitution contains a remedy for such abuses so central to our system of checks and balances that it appears in that document six times. That remedy? Impeachment. Our duty is to demand it from our members of Congress. This message is sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
You can't bring up, one guy sent me a very interesting thing about Barack Obama and race. You can't bring up anything other than that suddenly he's African-American. If you start to, you know, delve around the edges of, wait a minute, isn't he mixed race? Weren't we told that last year? Whatever, biracial? Not allowed to say that anymore. Apparently, the mainstream media has dubbed him to be African-American.
Yeah, I was driving in today, and I was seeing, because I saw this piece with him on 60 Minutes, and I thought to myself, he's very white. In many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, gee, can I even say that? Can I even say that without somebody else starting a campaign saying, what does he mean? He's very white. He is. He's very white.
When a Muslim without a birth certificate has taken over the White House, you need a good white former junkie to show you the direction that America needs to go in. Beck, it's What's for Demagogue.
This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Head on RadioNetwork.com, an internet-based conversation radio experiment. Available most easily at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a Listen Live button. Just jump right on it, and there you are. Or if you're on a mobile device, it's also easy to find us at TuneIn Radio. A nice app for your mobile smartphone, or Tuner Internet Radio, or Dar.fm, or Stitcher Radio, Streama.com. We are rather ubiquitous. I mean, if we got more every night, we'd be paying salaries, right? Head on RadioNetwork.com.
This is Kamal Lamani, a.k.a. Kamal Supreme. I'm in Brooklyn, Brooklyn, Medina, with my man Jonathan, his daughter Jasmine, my cousin Will, my wife Diane, my baby Hassan, and we are NewBlackMusic.net. And the name of this poem I'm about to do is called The N-Word. Historically, we're forgetting where we came from and what the black man and woman do in America transmits all over the world and possibly the universe. But people are getting the wrong interpretation of our culture, history, and words such as the N-word. So they're using it lightly. Now, if we're going to use it, I don't think it should be as a term of endearment. Maybe dramatically, like I'm doing in performance poetry, you know, or maybe in a drama to show forth our history and bring forth meaning. But it shouldn't be something that anybody can toss off their lips, because We can't call Jews certain names because we'll be anti-Semitic, and we can't call Hispanics certain names because we'll be anti-them. So we can't call white people certain names, so why should we allow people to call us nigger? Why should we call ourselves nigger as a term of endearment? You know, I read articles that there's a store in Africa called Nigger, and they say they got that from Puff, and they think there's nothing wrong with nigger. They just was listening to his hip-hop, and that nigger's a good thing over there, you know? And, you know, I got white boys calling each other nigger, calling black people nigger, Spanish calling black nigger. Gotta stop. Gotta stop. Everybody got to get back into the history, for real. We're glorious people, but we forgetting our history. We're here for a reason. God only let us come here because he know we can handle it. So let's handle it and let's rise above it and let's rule again. Rule righteously. What's up, my nigga? With the term of endearment that he gave, I paused and looked around like, you talking to me? Because to me, a nigga is a modern day slave. See, niggas is living in America with one foot in the devil's grave. But because you getting paid, nigga, you think you got it made, nigga. You think you got power because you can pull a trigger, nigga, and kill your brothers and sisters, nigga. Because you are irate and you can show and prove that you hate a nigga. My father used to say the black man is a coward. Because he want to act like a man. Real men are handling affairs of the world. Real men are trading diamonds, copper, gold, oil, steel, and uranium. Real men are thinking long range and manipulating interest rates in the stock exchange. While niggas is playing games. Niggas is playing games like, who shot ya? Niggas is playing games like, who's darker? And who look like Beyonce? And who look like Miss Parker? Who got the baddest prefabricated MTV crib? Who got the baddest ass, girl? What you mean? You should be playing hopscotch, girl. You only 13. And who's pimping they ride? Nigga, do you know what pimp means? Nigga, you being pimped by the establishment as a political machine. Niggas are being pimped by immigrant merchants in our hoods. We got Arabs selling us swine, blunts, and cancer sticks. Koreans selling us hip-hop clothes. And international niggas selling us what we put up in our nose. Parasites. You ask them, yo, why you buy from Parasites? They be like, shh, it's all good, dog. It's all gravy. Niggas is being pimped by the Army, Air Force, Marines, and Navy. Niggas are being pimped by the prison industrial complex. You think niggas pimping just got to do with money, cash, hoes, and sex? Niggas need to study lessons that Elijah, Malcolm Lewis, Clarence, and them gave. And maybe niggas will realize that a nigga is a modern day slave. Nigga.
This is APNS Public Radio.
Go on, chillin'. That what we the talk about. We need a little help. Can't do this y'all alone. Thank God for this. Lick. Jim Brown, y'all. Yes, this your evening. One more time. We the ask on the chillin' for get up. Get into it. Get involved. Oh, Hunter Chillin, when I have to come down here to the Gullah Geechee Nation, I'm so glad that Hunter to tune in to we Gullah Geechee Rhythm Radio Station. Hunter Chillin, know this year the head from the body of this year nation and the heart of we station. Queen Quest, come on, Chillin, get involved, get involved, get involved to the Gullah Geechee Sea Island Coalition, the sponsor of this year radio station. Hunter Chillin, this year the we show, Gullah Geechee Rhythm Radio. Come on, y'all.
Let's do it. Hello, I'm George Papard. Suppose you're eating with a friend and he suddenly begins to choke. Would you know what to do? If he can cough, leave him alone. Don't pound on his back. But if he can't cough, talk, or breathe, or if he only makes a high-pitched wheezing sound, you must take action. Here's what to do. Move behind your friend and put your hands like this, right between the navel and the rib cage. Then pull sharply in and up as many times as necessary. What's happening is this. The food is acting like a cork in a bottle. When you pull in the stomach, you force the trapped air to pop the cork out. You can even do this to yourself, using the back of a chair or your own fist. It's simple, but it can save lives. The Will Rogers Institute has a free booklet about this technique and the variations you should use for pregnant women. It also shows how to reduce the chances of choking, especially for children. For your free copy, write The Will Rogers Institute, White Plains, New York.
HIV संक्रमित हरुलाई माया ममता र समाजमा सम्मानित जीवन जिउने वातावरण निर्माण गरौं।
यो उनीहरुको अपेक्षा होइन अधिकार हो।
रोगलाई तिरस्कार र बहिष्कार गरौं, रोगीलाई होइन। एचआईभी अरुलाई मात्र होइन, तपाईलाई पनि लाग्न सक्छ।
सकारात्मक सोच, स्वस्थ समाज अनि सही निर्णय नै सरल तथा सफल जीवन हो।
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास।
Christmas is hard on the national minimum wage.
At Christmas time, we give what some employers take. And we know that they have plenty, but they give out less and less. Stand up against the great. It's Christmas time.
Yeah.
society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
And we'll talk about they don't hate anyone and they don't wish to see people maybe being killed. They say those things publicly because it sounds good for the camera. But when the cameras are shut off, members of organized white supremacist groups do sit around plotting to kill people, talk about assassinating people and blowing up buildings.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
This ends our news flash.
Sagen Sie jetzt mal bitte,
Anarchie.
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 Ob geschichtlich oder brandaktuell.
Mit Berichten und Interviews, mit Beiträgen und Collagen.
Beleuchtet das anarchistische Radio Berlin das Phänomen des Anarchismus.
Viva Anarchie!
At the Congress of the International of Anarchist Federations, IFA, we had the opportunity to talk to an anarchist comrade from Azerbaijan who told us about the case of two imprisoned comrades facing long sentences.
For security reasons, we re-recorded this interview with our own voices. I'm here with someone from Azerbaijan and we heard that currently there are two anarchists imprisoned in Azerbaijan. Can you maybe tell us about the background, why they were imprisoned?
They were imprisoned for a protest action in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, in May of this year. You must know that the government in Azerbaijan made a public holiday, a so-called Flower Day, on the day of the birth of the former dictator, Heydar Aliyev. His son, Ilham, is now president, and so they have introduced this Flower Day some years ago. They make some big pictures at the rally with flowers and the Azerbaijan flag. And of course they're spending a lot of money, because all of the flowers are sent from the Netherlands, and that's quite expensive. They were doing this before, and this year, on the night of the 9th of May, two of our comrades, they wrote, quote, "fuck the system," unquote, with an anarchist sign, and instead of Happy Flower Day, they wrote Happy Slave Day. That sounds very similar in the Azerbaijan language, gul and gul, and they were arrested the next day. It's a tradition of the Azerbaijan state to arrest political activists by putting drugs into their homes. They put to each of our comrades 1 kilogram of heroin, and for that they will receive a sentence of between 8 and 12 years.
And if they were just sent